Today, no V-shaped recovery here. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance abroad news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
Good, Martin. How are you?
Pretty good. We live in interesting times, don't we?
Well, we certainly do. Everything, it's all happening at once. You know, you mentioned late last year that 2020 was going to be a big year, and here we are in March, and it already is.
Yep, we're only 2.5 months in, or just over 2 months, and it's already looking that way. I did my weekly post just over a week ago, so the Saturday before last, and I said that, in my view, the economic mirror could well crack. Last Saturday, 2 days ago, I said it did crack.
Did you ever think it would deteriorate this quickly?
Well, I had my suspicions, because I always felt that the coronavirus was the trigger, but it wasn't really the underlying cause.
Right? No, that's more or less a...
We've been building sandcastles on bad credit and central bank policy for at least a decade. So it was always going to come home. It's just a question of when and how.
Yeah, I'm really sort of becoming quite concerned about systemic stability at this point, because there's just so many different bubbles this could pop. It's not funny.
Correct. And they're all interconnected, and that's the point, right? So this isn't an isolated crisis in a particular geographic area. It's actually global in structure. And we, of course, have political leaders who look after their own backyard, Mr. Trump, compared with perhaps the global situation. So I think this is going to be different from GFC.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for ScoMo to kick off the next first homeowners grant, because I think we all know it's coming.
It's the only shot in his locker.
Yeah, pretty much, mate. I mean,
well, it is.
I mean, what do you reckon is going to happen with the property market and sort of?
It's going to definitely unwind. I'm already seeing in my surveys the leading indicator of propensity to buy dropping away, and the reason is uncertainty about their own employment and uncertainty about the future of the overall economy. So it's connected.
Yeah, it just makes me wonder if we finally come across a bullet that our property market can't dodge.
I suspect that we'll find the government will try and throw some more petrol on that particular fire, because it's the only one that's burning at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's a lot of bearishness out there about property at the moment. And to be completely honest, you know, in a free market, I would say it was rather warranted. But I think for the moment, they're going to buy a lot of time, throwing, you know, rate cuts, QE, throwing, you know, probably a first homeowner's grant and God knows what else at the market, because they know that if that goes, it's going to take the rest of the economy with it.
Well, it's the only game in town for them at the moment, and the Reserve Bank has pretty much said as much as Treasury has too. So you would expect them to continue to try to prop the property market up. And, of course, it has that psychological impact too, because if prices are not falling, people are going to feel more positive than if they are falling. If property prices also start to dive, that takes a further feedback loop then in terms of consumption. So you can understand why they do it. But it is so narrowly based as to be quite ineffective in the medium to long term.
Yeah, we spend we spend so much resources on it, you know, just in terms of tax concessions and rate cuts and the effect that has on the real economy and sort of, you know, like I was talking to a financial advisor the other day who's a mate, and he was just saying, you know, what a pension is supposed to do? You know, all we're doing is forcing all these people out of you know, term deposits, out of, you know, safe fixed income products, either into the market or onto the pension, and all it's going to do is just cost us more money in the bloody long run.
Yeah, it's almost the case you don't want to be a saver at the moment.
No, I mean, you really just, I mean, you know, personally, I'm a pretty prudent sort of guy, and I don't mind just, you know, waiting on the sidelines for the most part, but, well, waiting on the sidelines in US dollars, to be honest, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have been asking me, what's going to happen with property? And the answer is short term. I mean, I can't really see a drop in the sort of next 3 or 4 months, can you?
It could, but it depends a little bit, I think, what happens over the next couple of weeks. So if the Reserve Bank cuts hard, as they could do even 50 basis points, they probably will try and prop it up. But the question is that really feasible? You know, there's a... Who knows to that. It depends on, I would watch unemployment. To me, unemployment is the, unfortunately, the lagging indicator, but the critical indicator.
Yeah, I think, I mean, looking at the ANZ job ads for February, I think it's probably going to be quite, you know, probably 2 or 3 months before we start to see like a really sort of big impact on the on hiring intentions, at least.
Well, the NAB survey was pretty negative. The PMI out today was pretty negative. So, you know, who knows? It will take a little bit of time, but yeah, lots of moving parts.
Well, I must say, having you say "who knows" about something on a short time horizon should be concerning for people in and of itself.
I should get my crystal ball out. I have it here. Hang on a moment. There you go. This is my crystal ball. It's extremely cloudy just at the moment, Tarek, I'm afraid. You know, unfortunately, it's not as clear as it should be. Come on, wake up. Oh, there you go. I can change colour, but that's about it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to be effective in forecasting unemployment.
In fact, it's on the blink. There you go.
That's just perfect, isn't it? That should be the title of one of your videos. The crystal ball is on the blink.
Yeah, well, we might even use that as part of this show. And what, of course, is interesting is that the coronavirus is the trigger, but essentially it's laying bare the deep cracks that lay around the economy globally.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that's something that I've really been sort of just trying to examine over the last, you know, few weeks. You know, people say it's going to, you know, potentially cause a global recession in and of itself. That's sort of becoming some a theme amongst analysts on Wall Street. But really, in and of itself, it's a rather significant threat. But when you think about all these other potential things, like the weak European banking system, you know, an overleveraged Chinese corporates, the U.S. you know, corporate debt bubble, when you put it with any one of those things, and you've got the potential catalyst for the next global crisis, or multiple bubbles all going at once, we just don't know.
Well, the point, of course, is that we've had massive run-ups in stock market valuations, and that's been driven by very free stimulation from the Fed and other central banks around the world as they've cut interest rates, done QE. And it's worth recalling that the Federal Reserve has put more than $500 billion back into the markets for liquidity purposes since the repo crisis back in September. And around the world, the total piles of debt have never been higher. The total amount of debt amongst households has never been higher. And the number of central banks around the world operating at zero or below interest rates have never been higher. And yet here we are at the start of a rather significant set of events, rather than the sort of the start of a recovery, as it were. And if you recall that last time around, they had 4 to 5% of interest rate cuts to play with to insulate the financial markets from the effects of the global financial crisis. This time, that doesn't exist.
Exactly right. I mean, when you examine the last, say, 12 years since the financial crisis, we've done exactly what they tell households not to do. We've tried to solve a debt problem with more debt. And obviously, that was always going to end poorly in the long run. And as you say, the reality is this time, there just isn't the ammunition to be able to fight this in the same way as it was during the GFC. It's going to have to be a lot more unconventional policies. Well, not have to, but that's likely what's going to happen. And even if you just look at fiscal policy, if you look at, say, China, you know, there are a lot of people at the moment expecting the Chinese government to, you know, throw trillions of dollars at infrastructure. There's going to be this big boom and all these different things. And the reality is, do they have the ammo to do that? Do all these different countries all the way around the world who have all been running significant deficits for a long time, you know, at multiple levels of government, do they have the ammo to be able to do that again? And I don't think they do have the ammo to do it on that scale again.
Well, no, I think there's a few things going on there. The first is there's this sort of Keynesian view, right? So that in a crisis you stimulate. It's just that they forgot that went on for a short period and then you need to stop and then recover, right? So they're still simulating from, you know, 10 plus 11 years ago. So the GFC overhang is still there. And the doctrinal thinking amongst central banks, which I think they almost feel as though they've become omnipotent. They just, put some more liquidity in the markets and everybody says, oh, whoopee, the financial markets are now fine again and let's go on. They forget, of course, that there's a connection to the real economy and real people and real households. If you think of what's happened to interest rates as they've come down, you know, savers are being taken to the cleaners. People being encouraged to get larger and larger mortgages, which pushes house prices up, and it also pushes other asset prices up. But a lot of the asset prices, particularly in the stock markets, are explained by the fact that corporates can now borrow next to nothing in terms of interest rates, and then just buy back their own shares. So it's not actually real productive growth. It's effectively just a symptom of this ultra-free monetary style. And it doesn't actually lead anywhere. So if you look at Europe, you know, they've had negative rates for quite some time. And now people are talking about the fact that the central bank policies are pretty much ran out of smoke there. We know that Japan has been at it for years without any real positive effect. And we've only had one bank, I think it was Sweden, who recently lifted their negative rate up a little towards positive territory, saying we've got to find a different path. We have groupthink at very least amongst central banks, and some people would say we have a coordinated set of strategies across central banks that are not in the interests of the average person.
No, certainly not. You know, I find it really quite interesting when you look at all these other different measures of productivity, of the benefits to the real economy. And the reality is that they're more or less flatlined recently. You know, they throw all this money at the system, you know, low rates. And realistically, what is it accomplishing? You know, you'd think with ultra easy monetary policy, we would be seeing, you know, according to, you know, sort of central bank doctrine, we'd be seeing, you know, 3-4% GDP growth in the world. And, you know, we're just not seeing that.
Yeah, well, the key point there, of course, is that very low rates ultimately get to the point where banks themselves get caught in the trap, because essentially they can't take deposit rates any lower because they're already at zero, and their margins for lending are also now very compressed. So they have difficulty in extending further credit, despite the fact that central banks want them to. And in fact, if you look at a recent report that came out of the central banks in Europe, what they said was that banks do three things. Firstly, they tend to lend less rather than more when rates come down. Secondly, they are caught in this interest rate trap because effectively they can't take deposit rates into negative territory for the bulk of deposits. It just doesn't work because people will take money out of the banks, and that forces liquidity issues on the banks. And therefore, they have to turn to speculative activities to be able to try and generate revenue, which means that you actually get more speculation in the derivatives sector, which is huge around the world, never been bigger, or other trading income. And so this whole set of philosophies, which is take rates low, put lots of liquidity in the system, may lift asset prices through the stock markets and may lift asset prices through property markets, but actually from a real economy perspective, it's not working.
No, absolutely not. And I think that's something that's really, really important to remember going forward, is that basically all these sort of unconventional monetary policies, all the QE, all the negative rates, all those sorts of things that are in all likelihood going to be tried, you know, when and if this crisis becomes that serious, aren't going to work. You know, we are risking the stability of the financial system on basically keeping this party going, keeping the easy money going forever and ever. But what happens when the music stops? What happens when someone turns around and says, okay, wait a minute, I'm not willing, you know, whether it's a pension fund or an insurance company turns around and says, well, look, I need 7.25% to pay my liabilities. Holding these, you know, German 10-year bonds or holding these bonds at 0.5%, that's not going to cut it anymore. And at some point, you know, people are going to turn around and they're going to say, no, I'm not going to accept this. This is systemically dangerous, and rates have to rise. Whether it's, you know, a significant rise or whether it's just, you know, a rise back to like sort of what we've seen since the GFC is obviously, you know, a matter of great debate. But at the moment, we are literally talking about risking the sort of base stability, the foundations of the financial system, on something that's completely untested on a grand global scale, and something that has completely failed in Europe and Japan to promote any real growth in the real economy.
Yeah, well, it's an experiment, Tarek, that's been running on for a long, long time now. And, you know, everybody says, well, just put a bit more in. And, you know, there's that old definition of, you know, lunacy. You basically continue to do the same thing and expect a different result, right? It's not going to happen. And the other point there is that, of course, people are forgetting that whilst you can probably support the financial system by just putting more debt in and basically just inflating it, you know, the fallout for real people is horrible, right? Because effectively we've got incomes going absolutely nowhere. We've got real productivity going through the floor because real investments in businesses are not being made. And so you've got this shadow world where the financial system is being protected by the central banks and they think they've done their job. And yet the real economy and real people, and, you know, real unemployment rates and all those things, they're going to get really dented by what's going on. And yet we seem to have groupthink amongst politicians and we have groupthink amongst central banks. And they're all just concerned about the financial system, not the real economy. And, you know, to my mind, we've got to put a bit of a line under that and say we need a different path.
No, and you're absolutely right. And I think one of the really, really important problems that we're going to face is we have a consumer-driven economy. You know, we're not a manufacturing-driven economy. We're not a diversified economy here in Australia. We're a consumer-driven economy, and we have been destroying the purchasing power of real purchasing power of consumers because we've had no wage growth and the set input costs that people have to pay, like electricity, housing or health insurance, all these different things have been rising well above the, you know, wage growth. And that's something that's been occurring around the world. You know, like you look at, you know, in the US, the cost of health insurance now is more or less on par with the cost of servicing a mortgage or paying rent. So we have this situation where we've been supporting asset markets, where we've been supporting, you know, the financial system, but the perverse thing that's happened is that we've been, you know, slowly eating away at the real economy, at the consumer economy that we've built around the world, you know, in the last sort of 30 or 40 years. And we've just been hollowing it out. And the question really is in my mind, that if we do see a crisis, how exactly are we going to recover out of it? Where is the recovery going to come from? Because if the real economy, because this time it's not the financial system that's suffering, at least not yet. It's going to be real people who can't go to work, or real people who have depressed demand, you know, are dealing with depressed demand at their jobs, who are getting hours cut. And the question is, what happens to them? How can we have a consumer-driven recovery if consumers don't have the money to consume?
Yeah, so what's interesting there is, if you think about the way the economy works, it's very much driven off two things. The services sector and consumer spending. About half of the GDP number is made up of consumer spending. Now, consumers aren't spending, and that's because they can't, because they don't have the rising incomes and the fact that their confidence levels are pretty shot, and therefore they're putting money into paying down loans or saving where they can. The other point, though, the services sector is like pass the parcel. You basically have a set level of expenditure in the economy and just moving the parcel around and around the economy faster and faster. But it's not actually adding to the total value in the economy, right? Because we've actually hollowed out manufacturing. We've hollowed out those things that were actually creating productive contributions to the economy. We're reliant on our exports to China, which, of course, at the moment is creating significant issues for us. And that's particularly true, of course, for iron ore and for coal. And then, of course, we've got education and we've got, you know, the tourist sectors. All of those are the ones now at massive risk. And I think what this does show is that the economic stresses in Australia over the last 20 to 30 years have taken us into a cul-de-sac. We do not have a growth engine. We do not have a mechanism to build an economy other than pushing services, problem there, and pushing consumer consumption, problem there. Therefore, where do we go?
Well, exactly right. You know, that's the economy that we've built. You know, I think about it sometimes, and it's just, and you know, some people talk about it, it's like, well, you've got the barista who pays the personal trainer, who pays the accountant, who pays the so on and so on and so on. And, you know, you just think about that from a purely sort of analytical perspective. And you just think, if you take that one person out of that chain, if you start to see rising unemployment and all of a sudden people's that flow of money within the services economy slows, you know, significantly, you know, you're stuffed. You know, and the question is, how do we kickstart that? We don't, like you say, we don't have the manufacturing capacity. We don't have all these other industries or tech or all these other things that, say, dragged America out of its recession, you know, during the GFC. And I don't really know how exactly we're going to drag ourselves out of this, especially as indebted as we are.
Well, you know, maybe the hydrogen industry, if you can invest in that, and that might create some momentum down the track. And maybe if we actually thought more creatively about how to react and respond to climate change and create new industry off the back of that. But, you know, all of that is going to take a lot of time. And I just am worried that we don't have a huge amount of time left. So basically, the strategy from both Treasury and from the RBA is to try and encourage people to spend more by lifting home prices, by effectively making it easier to borrow. But I don't think that's going to work, because one of the things we're going to see now, I think, is probably home prices beginning to go back down again to an extent that it has recovered, you know, in the last 6 months. Because at very low debt levels, people still have to be able to repay the debt at some point. And if unemployment is rising, and I think it will rise quite a lot faster now than people were expecting, that's going to be a significant issue. And the PMI data that came out today, the Purchasing Managers Index, is actually well down as well. So basically, confidence is shot. Therefore, you know, you wonder quite whether the RBA cutting the rates, as they probably will do tomorrow, will have much impact. The government's talked about selective fiscal support for some sections of the economy, but no big fiscal stimulus. We seem to be, frankly, up the creek without a paddle.
Well, I think you made an important point there with unemployment. I think that's going to be the absolute key thing to watch going forward from both an economic and political perspective. Because if we start to see unemployment rise significantly, sort of up towards 6.5%, 7%, you know, sort of the danger zone of unemployment rates, if that starts to occur, we're going to see some rather big shifts politically, because you can't run an immigration program where you're bringing in 300,000 people every year when you've got 7% unemployment. You know, people are going to look at that and they're going to go, well, I don't want 1.2 other people in that 7-person unemployment line to have to compete with. You know, not in a downturn, not now. And I think that's really something that's really going to undermine the current Australian growth engine that has been just sort of, what do they call it, population QE infinity. And if we don't start to address the issues that we have, if we don't start to diversify our economy, sort of realistically, we need a time machine at this point to actually meaningfully sort of solve the issues that we have. We need to start to acting now to be able to arrest these problems, because it's all well and good for Albo and ScoMo to just sit there and go, oh, no, it's all right, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing for the last 12 years since the GFC. You know, we're going to keep betting the farm on China. But you know, there's no guarantee that China is going to come back from this as strong as they are, as strong as they were before. You know, it's going to cost them billions of dollars, possibly trillions of dollars, to kickstart their economy, to be able to cover all these debts and all these bad loans and all these different problems that are going to crop up as a result. You know, only a little over 30% of Chinese small and medium businesses are actually back at work. And those are official figures from Beijing. So they might be good, they might be, you know, fabricated, we don't. But even that is a pretty bloody bleak thing at the moment. And I really just don't see how exactly we're going to drag ourselves out of this unless we start acting now. You know, we need to stop betting the farm on China. We need to stop that complacency, because otherwise, who knows where we're going to be in 18 months, 2 years' time.
Right. And just to reflect on that, you know, the forward projections relating to the virus are that this could run on for quite a few months. And in fact, the peak could be quite a lot later in the year, which means that essentially this is not going to be a short, sharp bounce down and then a bounce back. Right. But this is going to be a long, slow grind, and a long, slow grind that puts more pressure on businesses so that they don't invest, can't employ. And as you say, the China connection probably being off the boil for quite some time suggests that the overall economic trajectory here is going to be pretty weak.
I completely agree. And that's another interesting fact with Australia, given the fact that we're in the Southern Hemisphere, is that there have been some theories that as the Northern Hemisphere warms up, as Europe, you know, comes out of winter, and you know, China comes out of winter, that perhaps maybe that's going to help control the virus, because there are going to be fewer people who are already sick, fewer people who already have weakened immune systems. But Mark McGowan, the Premier of WA, came out and said the other day that he doesn't expect a significant uptick in the number of Australian cases until April or May, with the number not peaking until August during the peak of our flu season. So that really raises an even bigger issue for Australia as well, just for ourselves domestically, because the rest of the world may hopefully hopefully by the end of this, the first half of this year, be getting on top of this, and hopefully we'll be able to start to see some sort of recovery. But domestically, we may have serious coronavirus issues well into the end of the third quarter.
Yeah, well, and there's a limit, of course, to what governments can actually do in that situation. And I think one of the things I'd say is that the assumption that some of central banks are going to magically pull another rabbit out of the hat, as we discussed earlier, ain't going to happen this time. So we'll be back to what the government can and should do. But I think we've got to brace for impact, but also brace for long-term impact.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw some calculations that Lindsay David did on Twitter for, you know, sort of a short repayment holiday in something in the order of a $700 billion cost. And I just saw that and I was like, whoa. You know, there's this idea that the government, you know, the government's huge, they collect all our taxes, they can just force the banks to give us a repayment holiday, but it's not that simple at all. You know, there's so many different secondary effects that are going to result from that, aside from the obviously enormous cost, even if they chose to do that. You know, issues with ratings, issues with how overseas investors perceive our creditworthiness, as you've covered in the past. You know, we have an absolutely enormous exposure to foreign debt.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess the final thing I wanted to touch on was the political context here, right? Because, you know, at one level, ScoMo seems to be a bit on the front foot and trying to take the lead, unlike in the bushfires. And yet, if you look at his rhetoric closely, there isn't really a lot to see, is there?
No, there isn't. There's no real sort of let's do a stimulus. There's nothing really. And I think that really just goes to show his ideological priorities. You know what I mean? Like I said on our last chat, pretty much every other nation in the region, including New Zealand, I might add, our little brother, everyone, more or less everyone, is doing some form of stimulus program. Now, I do understand at this point a stimulus may or may not be effective depending on how the virus plays out in Australia. I will concede that, absolutely. You know, if we have a major outbreak tomorrow, there's not really a whole lot of point throwing money at consumers because they're not going to be able to do anything but save it. And that's fair, but the reality is that we need support for industry. We need support for all these different things. You know, I've had messages from people from, you know, industry from across the board saying that they're running out of stock, that they're going to have significant problems, most in sort of late May, early April, you know, when their inventories will start to run low. And who's going to help these people? You know, these companies are going to have significant cash flow issues in the not too distant future. And for the moment, the government just seems content to just be like, well, we'll just tinker around the edges.
Right. And that cash flow issue you've just touched on is, for me, the critical linchpin in all this, right? Because the financial system is going to be under significant pressure because people will be unable to repay their mortgages on time. Businesses won't be able to actually repay the loans that they've got on time. And it's that flow back into the financial system, which I think we need to be very conscious of, right? Because the analysis that I've done suggests that the banks are actually not that well positioned to handle a significant downturn in terms of credit quality, which is what we're going to see, right? And I know that they ran stress tests and all those things, but the sort of stress test modeling that I've done suggests that if the liquidity drives up, as it could well, from because of the international financial markets, it's going to be quite hard for the banks to be able to manage this without going into significant financial distress on their own right. And that in turn, of course, then flows back. So I'm concerned about the second order and third order impacts as effectively it flows back. So they lend less, households then get into more difficulty. Businesses, of course, not employing means that you don't pay wages, which means that more households are going to effectively have difficulty in paying those loans. And so that sort of cycle of debt and cycle of distress rises, which puts more pressure back on the banks again, right? And the thing I want to highlight here is that all of the banks did their individual stress tests for APRA, but they did them in isolation, right? Now what we've got is a real live set of stress tests where we've got banks around the world all at the same time struggling with liquidity, struggling with these financial pressures in the system. And those isolated stress tests that were done were so Mickey Mouse, it was not modelling the real world. Well, all I'd say is, welcome to the real world. We've got some significant issues ahead, in my view.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, there are going to be some major, major issues for corporations, for corporate bonds, for all these various different things going forward. But I would also add that I think a lot of people are underestimating exactly how much the supply chain issues are going to impact the global economy and for how long that's going to last. You know, people say, "Oh, but China's going back to work. Things are going to get back to normal." Well, the Port of Long Beach in the U.S., which is the largest port of trade for trade with China, has already recorded a 25% drop off in the number of containers in total coming into their port. Now, that's just obviously going to be a significant issue for U.S. companies, you know, importing stuff from China. But the thing is, even if China goes back to work tomorrow, the lead-in time for manufacturing can be measured in months. You know, you've got to source the raw materials, source the components, source all these various different things before you can make the final finished product. And then, you know, it's not like the global supply chain isn't like Amazon, where you can order it and then all of a sudden it's out there at your front door a day later. You know, the lead-in times are frankly enormous. Like, for example, the time that it takes to ship a container, not including customs and not including loading, just port to port from China to the UK, is somewhere between 29 days and 41 days. So even if things resume tomorrow, we're still going to have another 6 weeks of shortages, another 6 weeks of things not being delivered that people need. And I'm already hearing stories from people of building sites running out of supply sometime in sort of mid to late March. And if we start seeing these supply chain issues starting to affect Australian businesses on a significant scale, ScoMo's really going to have to get his stuff together, because if not, we're going to be in serious trouble.
Yeah, well, you know, lots of different moving parts, a very complex situation. And I guess, you know, it's going to move differently perhaps to past crises because, you know, the GFC won't be replayed precisely the same again, although, boy, history sometimes rhymes. But I think we'll have to keep an eye on it and we'll come back again and talk about it as soon as things develop.
Yeah, well, I'll see you tomorrow then.
Thanks for that, Derek. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, mate.
Take care.